Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Métis Voices Radio Show, our own internet radio program at CBS Radio every Friday evening. Tonight, we start off the program by playing the Red River Jig by the Métis Toe Tappers. Our show begins at 7:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Station 2. To listen, just click the listen arrow at the top. If that doesn't work, scroll down and choose whichever listen live button works for you. Each show features a variety of subjects and special guests coming to you live from the Machif Métis Museum in beautiful Raven Beach, just outside of Clearwater, British Columbia, Canada. Call-in lines will be open throughout the program. Here are the numbers to call. In the U.S. and Canada, toll-free, 888-228-4494. And worldwide, toll-free, 877-489-6350. For direct lines, go to BBS Station 2 main page under the header Call In and Speak Live. And don't worry if you miss any of these call-in numbers. They are posted on the BBS Radio website, all stations, and repeated on the program. And now, introducing your host, Dale Haggerty.
And say, and welcome everyone to tonight's Métis Voices Radio. Tonight, we are very pleased to have as our guest, Lisa Hartley, a third-generation cousin of Louis Riel, telling us about her life and times as a Métis woman. Welcome, Lise.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I feel very honored to be with you tonight. Here in Hamilton, we had a very bad snowstorm, and we've got about a foot of snow. And so it really looks like Christmas, and doesn't happen as often, you know, here. We usually get maybe a little bit of snow, but not like this one. This was a real heavy snowfall. But anyway, I'm not here to talk about the snow. I just want to tell you that as I look back on my genealogy, I find that the La Jumadière family and the Nôtre family were connected. Josephette, known as La Cypresse, La Jumadière, married Amab Nôtre in they don't give me the date of their marriage, but they had 10 children. And Jean-Baptiste Nault, N-A-U-L-T, was my grandmother Véronique Nault's dad. And Véronique Nault is my grandma. And my dad is Joachim Huppé. Véronique Nault married Julien Huppé. And all these, the people I'm naming, were born around the same time as Louis Riel. Because Louis Riel's family, his mother was Julie La Jumadière. So you see where the connection is.
Oh, yeah. Now I do. Yes.
Yeah. And so I'm not sure. I tried to find André Nault. Because, you know, André and Louis Riel were in the thick of this. I don't call it a rebellion. I just find that that's a very bad word, because those people were only trying to save what they had, the little they had, you know. And when the Canadian government decided that they were going to take over, well, I don't think that anyone would appreciate someone coming and, you know, if somebody was coming to your backyard and going to put up a fence or a, or a tent or something, wouldn't you ask questions?
Oh, yes, yes. That's what I tell my students all the time when I'm at my school. And, you know, when we call it a resistance rather
it
than
is.
A rebellion.
Absolutely. It's a resistance because those people just felt that they were being pushed around, and nobody had the decency to say, by the way, why don't we sit down and see what we can come up with? You know, they thought, again, Aboriginal people should be pushed away or disappear or whatever, you know. I guess we were just not quite what they wanted to settle the country, but doesn't matter. We were there. In fact, all around St. Vital and Winnipeg, where the rivers meet, all our people were there. And it was the Red River settlement.
Yeah.
You know, and people some were farmers, but a lot of them still had the same old hunting and fishing and living. And, you know, the buffalo hunts, everything was always the same for those people. And when the Hudson Bay Company sold all Rupert's Land to Canada, well, these people were just sort of displaced. And why not fight for your rights?
Well, there was some sort of an agreement that I heard, and you know, I've always was
you,
under
I,
the.
You, go ahead.
I was under the understanding that when Hudson's Bay sold, or Rupert's Land sold its land to Canada, at the time it was the four provinces at the time, or confederation.
Yeah.
They had made a deal with that the Métis had. A land given to them, and this was part of the actual condition of the sale of the land to Canada.
Yes, probably. You're talking about the script. Probably.
Yes, of course. Well, that's how they had to distribute the scripts.
Yes, but you know that those people, very few had any education, or they couldn't speak English, the French part, the French people around St. Boniface and all the southeast. They had no idea what all this was about. And you know, there was a lot of land grabbers that say, I can give you $100 or $160, you know, for to buy their script. You know, I have a script here that was under my own grandpa, Julien Huppé. And he didn't sign it. He put an X there, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that those people were really mistreated. And my own, very own people lived, some of them, around the Broken Head Reserve. Well,
okay.
You know, they had to move because people were dispersed all over. Because when Louis Riel, when John McDonald decided that, you know, these upstarts weren't going to do him, to tell him what to do, he sent the army. And, you know, these people had nothing to defend themselves with, and those soldiers went out there and shot the Indians and the Métis for a Sunday afternoon something to do.
I know.
So it was a very sad and ugly piece of history that most people don't know anything about.
Oh, I know. Like, you know, like my ancestries are, and I only go back to, like, my mom's maiden name is Villeneuve.
Villeneuve,
yes. Yeah, and,
yes.
And her mother's maiden name was Vandal.
Vandal.
Vandal, yeah.
Les Vandal. Oh well, see, the Vandals are all in my family.
Oh, you got to be kidding! You know it. Yeah.
Oh.
Anyways, that's my side. So, my great grandfather. Sorry, my great grandfather was his name was Matilda Henry was my grandmother. That was her maiden name, and my grandfather was Isidore Villeneuve, or we say Villeneuve because we don't do the French pronunciation, but Villeneuve.
Yeah. You see, I'll name you some. Justine Vandal, Josephette Vandal, might be Isabelle Vandal, Marie Desjardins, Alfred Bédard. Do you see all those names? Nolan, even Nolan, you know, Joseph somebody. This is a handwritten from a priest that was giving down, you know, the Joseph, Huppé, then there's Daniel, Prou, P-R-O-U-L-X, Prou, Pierre Ducharme, Durand, lots of Ducharme, Desjardins.
Wow.
See, all those names are still all here. And the notes, you see, there's a Vandal here, Simone Bernard married to Eustache Vandal.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Josephette Saint-Cyr.
Yeah.
You see? Charbonneau.
Yeah. The funny part about it is...
Flamand.
I was saying, it's funny that my part of that family was part of that, the 1869 Louis Riel First Resistance. And, of course, it was Gabriel Dumont that took that group of people back to the St. Laurent settlement that he had just put together in Saskatchewan. And they ended up being... my great grandfather Joseph Vandal, which was my grandmother's father, and his wife was Champlain.
Okay.
So they lived on the one side of Gabriel Dumont, and then my other grandfather. Great grandfather Isidore Villeneuve lived on the other side with his wife Matilda Henry.
Yes.
So they were all good friends. I mean, they were
and all related.
All related.
Because you know there wasn't that many people that they worked with and lived with. So there was a lot of intermarriage. You know, like the Vandals and Charbonneau and Huppé and Flamand, Ducharme. Sophie Atkinson. Atkinson is another one that married into the La Gimaudière.
Wow.
So it's really, really, this should not, my kids say, Mom, you should have write all that down before something happens to you. But, you know, I think, you never know. You think you're going to live forever, but I'm not. I'm 84, you know, so that's why
that's
I'm
what that. That's what happens when your kids are giving you the message and you should be doing this.
I should be doing it, yes.
It's important not only just to your family, but it's very important to our culture because...
Yes.
It ties our culture in with other families that are struggling and trying to find their own identity.
Oh, yes. It's so true. And, you know, out here in Ontario, see, the reason I came to Ontario is when all this was, my dad was born in September 1885, and Louis was hanged November 1885. That and the family were traumatized because of all this happening. And when my dad was old enough to leave home, he went towards the Minnesota borders in the eastern part of Manitoba, because they were into the lumber industry.
Yeah,
because the railroad had passed through, and they would load those boxcars full of trees, because it was to heat Winnipeg.
Listen, I think there's a caller on the line.
Okay.
Hello, is there somebody on the other line?
Yeah.
Welcome. What's your name?
It's Carol LeClaire. It's Elise's daughter.
Oh, what are you
I'm listening to the stories.
That's my daughter.
Yeah, I just wanted to call in and offer my my greetings and tell everybody how proud we are of our mother. She beats the path down and we follow.
That's right. Where are you from?
I'm from Dundas, Ontario. I'm in Ontario.
Oh, no. Are you in Dundas, Ontario now?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, okay, perfect. I thought you might have been in Vancouver or somewhere, but you're in Dundas.
No,
wow.
I'm in Ontario, yeah. And,
good old Ontario.
Yeah.
It's hard to be Métis in Ontario, I'll tell you.
Hey, that's one of the questions I was going to get to. But I'm going to ask your mom a little bit later about the struggles of being Aboriginal and being Métis
in Southern
Ontario.
Yeah.
Stay on
well,
the
that's
line,
great.
Carol.
I'll just keep on listening in if I can.
Yeah.
Yeah, stay on the line. You're okay. Stay on the line and you and listen. Sure.
That's
okay.
So continue with your story, Elise.
Oh yes. My dad met my mom because my mom was. Her name was Eva Bacon, Bacon, I guess, but we call it, she always said Bacon. And so she was born in Minnesota. In those days, Minnesota the American lines weren't as formalized as they were later on. So they would go back and forth, and my grandpa was working, with the lumber business as well. So my mom and dad got married, my mom had 10 children, 6 girls and 4 boys. The first boy and the last boy died at birth. But anyway, we were raised out there in the bush. My dad worked on the in the bush when they were first married, but he got a job working on the CN Railway as a laborer, and he worked there as long as I knew. You know, as long as I could remember, my dad worked on the railroad, and I think they were getting $15 a month. Would you believe that? But, you know, they worked hard. In the summer, they had big gardens and they had animals. And we were raised to work hard and money was not available. And if we wanted to go to the picnic, we had to work in the garden and, you know, pick potato bugs and stuff. So they didn't have any money, but they raised us to understand that if you have money, you're careful with it. So anyway, we lived at where the 49th parallel is, and we went to the Roseau, Minnesota, for everything, doctors, dentists, anything that we needed, we went there to the States. It was just like, you know, 5 miles. So, and then when I finished school, we were always were raised that as long as you were in school and, you know, you were at home, but when you finished school, then you should be looking for a job. So I went to Winnipeg. Well, there was no jobs in Winnipeg for people who looked like an Indian. Only thing I could get was housekeeping, working for somebody else, you know. And I had to eat in the kitchen because they didn't
know.
Yeah. So my first $20, I left. As soon as I had $20, I went to Toronto because we could hear, you know, the radio was just starting, and you could hear about Toronto, how really what a big city it was and all kinds of stuff. So off I came to Toronto, but then the war broke out, Second World War. And we lived through that. Then there was lots of work. You could get a job anywhere. And I thought, oh, isn't this great? Nobody knows I'm an Indian here. It was just a little more subtle, you know. They didn't just tell you off, right off, as when, like in Winnipeg, say, we don't want Indians here.
Yeah, so, you know, my mom had that same experience. You know, she was in Manitoba. She was put into the residential system, and then when she finally got out, she was about 19 years old, and she went and lived with my sister, or my aunt, which was her sister, the older sisters, in Red Deer, and then she went to Edmonton to find a job, and at that time, it was just the war was just starting or something like this, or the war had just were coming to an end, and Canada Packers was always looking for good people to work in there, and my mom, you know, not knowing because of her identity loss, that she said to that's the first thing that they asked her was that she was an Indian.
Yeah, and if you say yes, you don't get a job.
And you know what she said? She says, "Oh no, I'm French."
Yeah. Oh yes, yes.
Because she had the Villeneuve last name, so she says, no, I'm French. Well, my name is Villeneuve. I'm French.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
But isn't that
awful? You know, I remember very well when I was a kid going to school in Vassar, Manitoba. That's where I was born, Vassar, Manitoba. It's right near the Minnesota border, as I said. We were told that we were French Canadians, and our father was a British subject, therefore we were British subjects, and the Métis language better disappear. They put in teachers that would ridicule the Métis language. And when the teachers would tell us that the inspector was coming maybe next week, we had to remember to take those French books and put them all in the cupboard, because the inspector went around from in row after row and picked up a scribbler, you know, the kids book, the books we had on our desk, and to see that they were English speaking. We were only supposed to speak English during the school hours. French was from 3:30 to 4:00, and that's when what we call the Protestants would leave, and the French kids that were supposed to be French had to stay and learn the French language, and the priest would come around and say that if we didn't, we were sinning, big sins, had to go to confession.
Oh, I'll tell you.
Yeah, yeah. There was just a lot of garbage. Makes you, you know. I always said to my mother, and she'd say, "You're the devil's own." Every time I turn around, I'm sinning. What kind of world is this, and what kind of religion is this that I have to? You tell me I'm sinning all the time. She said, "The devil is going to be going to get you." Oh well, I said, "Let him come," because I was always one, you know. I'm the only really one that left Manitoba at a young age, and you know, strike out for myself and see what I can do. And I guess I'm still doing it. So.
Jesus. Yeah, so there you did. You So actually, you were not brought up. You were never brought up Métis then, were you?
Oh yes. Oh, we were Métis. Our little community was definitely Métis.
You
we
were
all spoke,
okay.
But when you went to school, that's when you couldn't. The Métis were, you know, they wanted that Métis out of us. We were supposed to be French Canadians. And that's why, you see, they looked at your genealogy, and if they found a French-speaking person in your genealogy, that's what you had to be.
So then, you've basically, even though you've lived quite a bit of your time, you lived most of your life in Ontario right now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I going back home.
Sorry. Was Hamilton is where you first started out, or it was in Toronto?
Oh, I went to Toronto first. Yeah.
But then I
got a job in Hamilton. That's why I came to Hamilton, because the jobs in Toronto were all factory working, you know. And so in Hamilton, I got a job working in a school. So that was better for me.
Yeah, I've had the privilege. I lived in Ontario for 2 years. After 1986, I moved from Vancouver to... And I almost ended up living in Hamilton, but I ended up living in Kitchener-Waterloo.
Oh, yeah, that's not far.
And what I did was I was a glazier. I was a construction worker glazier, and
yes.
I was a journeyman. And so when there wasn't, I got a job in Kitchener for about 6 months, and the wages were so sad, I couldn't afford to stay there. So I looked for another job, and I got a job, and I was working downtown Toronto. I worked on that the Scotia Plaza down there in Toronto.
Oh,
you know that 77 story tall building in Toronto, downtown Toronto.
Oh,
I worked on that for about 8 months, and then I fell asleep at the wheel, and I was driving down 401, and I fell asleep at the wheel. And,
oh, my goodness. It's a lucky you're alive.
Oh, yes. I drove underneath the... I was about halfway underneath the semi-trailer truck.
Oh, my goodness.
And I woke up, and I could see the back wheels of this truck, and I'm going, I'm in trouble. I had a little car, right?
Oh,
so what
my
I
goodness.
Did, I slid back into the other lane, and I'll tell you, I went to work, and I was like frazzled, and I quit.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. My goodness, you could have been killed. You know.
Oh yeah, but it was scary there. So yeah. Is there somebody on the other line again? Hello.
No, I'm still here. I'm going to hang up so that other callers can call in.
Oh, okay, okay.
Okay, Carol.
Okay?
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
All right.
I'll talk to you tomorrow, Carol.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah. I have five daughters.
Wow, you got five daughters.
Five
wow.
daughters, yeah. I never had, well,
my experience.
Every time I got pregnant, I thought, well, maybe I'll have a son. But it never happened. But that's okay. They're just wonderful kids. I just, I don't know what I'd do without them. They're just great. I worked hard because, my first husband, was a construction worker as well, and they drank a lot. And he got in a car accident, and that was the end of him. So, but the girls were all grown up by then pretty well, so I was on my own for about 2 years, and then I met my second husband, and we had a wonderful life together, but he got Alzheimer's.
Oh.
So now he's in a long-term care. And that's a very sad thing for me. Because he is responsible for doing this genealogy. Because when we first met, I started to tell him about, you know, who my relatives and everything, and he just said, You should write that down. You should have that ready for the kids and everything. I said, I have no idea how to go about it. He said, I'll do it. And he did. And thank goodness, because he's the one that put all this together.
Yeah, that's absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
So listen, let me ask you a couple more questions. So you recently, you recently received the Status Woman Lifetime Achievement Award for. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I worked not only with the Métis, but also with the school boards and the. I was on board of directors at the university and. The school board and children's aid, and for the city of Hamilton, and doing work with the community. Like we here in Hamilton, we're right close to the Six Nations Reserve. You know, they're only maybe half an hour's drive from here, so we have a lot of contact. And here in Hamilton. We have the group of urban Aboriginal people, all different organizations like the Health Center, the Friendship Center, NIWASA, Head Start, the Métis Nation of Ontario, and ourselves, all worked together as we meet once a month as a group. To try and look after our people, and especially our homeless. So seeing that I've worked like this for 13 years, my name was put on the list like they send out for nominations from the Status of Women send people's names who you think deserves to be recognized for working in the community. So somebody, I guess it was the Métis Women's group, put my name in, and I was awarded the distinction. And I've got a nice ring to show for it. So, you know, I'm quite proud of being a recipient and working in the community. Right now we're working with our youth. We work with one of the high schools here in Hamilton where all the Miss guys that can't make it wind up at this high school. And we're working with them. We're bringing back the traditions and the ceremonies, and they have learned to drum, and they just they're doing very well. We started with seven kids, youth, Aboriginal youth, and we've got now 80. So in 3 years, we've accumulated that. So, you know, we're working with our kids. We want them to feel that they should be proud, proud of who they are, proud of being an Aboriginal person that understands and knows the natural ways of life, the circle of life.
Now, you know, that's very important to find your identity while you're young.
Yes.
Because, and be proud of it. I'm one of the late bloomers. I have no excuse except for just that my mom only hid our identity, and then I had no idea why she had hid her identity, and it was because of the residential system that she was stuck in.
Yes, yes, and because people, the Canadian culture looked down on Aboriginal people, you know. Sir John A. Macdonald did a very good job on the Aboriginal people. He made the rest of the conservatives think that we are some kind of something like a disease that you should try and get rid of. But we're back. And you know what? We're
stronger.
Stronger, and because suddenly, you know, some of our people have gone through the system, and now we can talk the same language as these politicians and know what's going on. See, our people didn't know. Our elders, our ancestors, were honest people, and they believed that people were telling them their truth. You know, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
Found out
later that
it was all lies, and you know, they might have signed their identity away.
Oh yeah,
the Métis people especially. You know, I can remember my dad saying that he heard his mother and grandparents talking that the commissioners came when Manitoba was being formed and said, "Oh, okay, what's your name? Oh, you've got a French name. Well, then you're Métis, then you don't belong. You know, you can't be with the Indians." They were separating the Métis people and you know what? The church was right there with them, saying, you know, the Catholic
I know that.
Catholic
Church is the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah, you bet.
They were the worst because they still have that same philosophy that, you know, that the Aboriginal spirituality it's not a religion. I say, no, nobody ever said it was a religion. It's part of being an Aboriginal person. That inside of you that connects with the Creator is what makes you who you are. You don't need a Pope, and you don't need anybody to tell you, you know, who you are once you accept and read your go to your teachings and remember that the world, you know, is a circle. And if you go by the medicine wheel, do you know anything about the medicine wheel?
Oh yes, I do. Yes,
well,
I'm very I'm spiritual in my own way.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you should know some of these ceremonies, but I've gone to the Star Lodge ceremony. Have you had the privilege?
Of what's that? What
it's
is it?
It's called the Star Lodge.
Star Lodge, no. No, but I've gone to Sweat Lodge. Is that the same thing?
Yeah, the Star Lodge is it's the same as the shaking tent sort of scenario.
Yes. I've
very.
Yeah.
You know. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I've heard of the shaking tent, and but I've never been in anywhere where there was one. But I've been in sweat lodges, and I'm going to be in a sweat lodge this Christmas time because I'm going up north to one of my daughters that's on the Fox Lake Reserve, and she said we're going to have a sweat lodge, and we're going to do a sweat ceremony because I think they're wonderful.
Yeah.
And so
you're
yeah.
a very busy woman. I'm reading something about you're the elder for the Native Women's Association of Canada. And
yes, I am.
Ontario Association. You're a very busy woman.
Oh yeah, yeah. I keep going. I'm like the Energizer Bunny. You know the.
Way to go, way to go. Oh,
yes. Yeah, yes.
I have to ask you this question,
what?
Though.
What?
You know, I live in British Columbia right now, and you know about our politics, about our...
Oh,
who's it?
Yes.
You also live in a province that is also going through an identity crisis, aren't you?
Yep.
How is it that we have a lot of problems with our First Nation people here? They're getting to accept this, except for way on the West Coast. There's still that identity problem of, you know, who's Métis and who's not Métis. But what about in Ontario? Can you give us some idea what it's like to live there as a Métis person? Because hey, listen, you know, Ontario wasn't the friendliest province when it came to Louis Riel in those days.
Oh, no, Ontario was orange country, the orangemen. And they really, that's why the Métis people in Ontario went underground. And a lot of them denied their Métis-ness, you know, they became mainstream. I always kept my identity because I came from Manitoba, you know, and but here the Métis people want once they hear or they come to our circle and they say, you know, my grandmother always denied that she was Indian, and. So they're learning. They're trying to figure out who they are, and but the trouble is, I think the trouble started when the Métis were identified through the what they call the rebellion, right? The Three Prairie Provinces, and they called British Columbia and Ontario the bookends because. They are saying there's no Métis in Ontario. There's no Métis anywhere except if you can find your roots to the Red River. Well, I think that's all nonsense. Who do you think was a Métis? All those coureurs de bois, in my estimation, were Métis guys because when the Frenchmen hit the shores of Quebec, there were no white women here. Who do you think they married in with or had children with? But again, in Quebec, the state and the church got together and really tried to assimilate or annihilate anybody that was mixed blood. So, I hear when I'm with the women for the national women, the Mi'kmaq that come from Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and New Brunswick say, there's no Métis in our area. And I said, how come? Well, they never established any Métis community. Well, I think that the government has a lot to do with that, because if all the Métis were identified, you know, there'd be more of us than them. So So I would love to see Métis people join together and as a nation and be proud, because, you know, those people in British, in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, there's lots of Métis there, but they can't. They just
they're
can't.
They're coming out now.
Yeah, they are. They are. But you see, the First Nations are really putting strong resistance over that. And I said to them, "Why? Why?" Well, they want to share our money. So it comes down to dollars and cents.
There you go. It's all about dollars and cents.
It's all about dollars and cents, yeah.
And this sad part about our whole culture is about dollars and cents. And it has no identity to the children. It has no identity to our elders.
Nope. It's all about dollars and cents. And you know that... I guess they're, I don't know for sure, but I think Ontario has only the northern part to identify as Métis. I don't know, the Métis Nation of Ontario, I have no connection there. For reasons of my own, I don't need anybody to tell me who I am, number one, you know. Number two,
you have two organizations out there. It's called the Métis Nation of Ontario, and then the Ontario Métis Associations, or something like this. Is that right?
The Ontario Métis Association went down; they went bankrupt.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So there's just the Métis Nation of Ontario now that is connected with the National Métis Council of the Three Prairie Provinces.
Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that the rest of us can't pick up our, you know, boots and let's go. We should be working together. And
yeah. Oh, yeah, I agree with you right now. There's so much problems, and you know, what the problem we have here is, we have a Métis National Council of British Columbia here, and they're claiming that they represent 60,000 Métis in British Columbia. Well, how come they only got a membership of maybe 4,000 members? And I'm giving them 4,000 members. I mean, the last time that was on their website, they said that they had 3,300 or 3,400. So, you know,
what's going on? Well, you know what's going on. It's just a money laundering, I guess, place. I don't know. I think that people have to be accepted. And what happened was, you know, that when they brought back the Constitution in Canada, 1984 or something, when the Canadian Constitution was brought to Canada.
Yeah.
The Métis got in as Aboriginal, Section 35 or something. But in, you see, they didn't go far enough to say that what would be the criteria, the identification for Métis? That's what I think they missed out on putting it down in paper. So we're going to have to work at this and find something that people can identify with as being Métis. Right now, if a person self-identifies, the community accepts them, and they can prove their genealogy, they're Métis, right?
Yep.
Well, why can't we use that in British Columbia and in the east part of Canada?
Well, this is first of all, this census that came out was a Canadian. It's a Canadian, and it's called the Census of Canada. And you know, you're supposed to fill this out truthfully.
Yes.
When you fill it out truthfully, and then there's 60,000 Métis that have self-identified themselves as Métis.
Yeah.
You know, they're filling out a federal document that. So.
Yeah, they can't be fraud.
What makes a group say you're not Métis when I've already filled out a federal document that says I am Métis?
Yes.
There's no way that this group should have that much power to say that, and that's the way I feel about it. And
yep.
until they can get off their high horses and get back to the people.
Yes.
I don't recognize.
No. I understand, and that's I don't belong to the Métis Nation of Ontario either. We the president and I had we had difficulty about different things. He understood very well who I was because he knows that I'm a Métis, and he would never be able to say it differently. But there was things that we disagreed on. It wasn't I felt that if a person identified as a Métis and had a genealogy and had on either side mother or father, they should, even if they were born in Newfoundland, they should be Métis. That's how I felt. Labrador have a Métis group, but the National Council didn't recognize them.
No, not at all.
So that's not right.
So I
was annoyed with that, and I thought, well, no, I can't work with people who just pick and choose or no. So
there you go.
Yeah, and so, you know, we need the thing is the Congress of Aboriginal People have the federal ear, the same as the National Métis Council.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
But
so listen.
Yeah.
So listen, if there's anything you have to or would like to say to all our listeners,
mm-hmm.
tell us
yes.
what you would like to say to these people that were listening to our great program.
Yes. Well, I would like to say that, you know, that all Métis should band together and work together as a nation, the same as any other nation. We should all, hold hands or from one end of the country to the other and say, we're Métis. We want our children to understand what Métis is. We are proud to be who we are. We, our ancestors opened this country. If it hadn't been for them, there would be a lot, maybe a lot different. Just think of the people who were in the fur trades. They were the fur traders are the ones that opened this country, because they're the ones that went from one coast to the other. And along the way, they met and married and had children. And so all that are Métis people. And Métis people are wonderful people. They have pride. They have the wherewithal. And they have the, not only the need, but the desire to get out there and be recognized. And I think we should do it. I would love to see from Labrador to British Columbia.
There you
go. Anybody put their card down, say, I'm Métis, and we're all one.
There you go. Well, folks, we're coming to a close here, and our time, boy, you didn't think you'd be on the air that much, but it doesn't take much to get on there, you know.
I know, time flies.
It sure does.
Yeah.
And I'd really like to thank you, and you know, if there's a chance that you're interested, maybe we can call you back and tell us how you're doing and stuff like this. This would be absolutely fabulous. You've been really a very interesting guest tonight.
Well, thank you very much. And if I make my way down to British Columbia, I'll send you an email first.
There you go. Well, thanks for listening. Yes, I really appreciate this. Well, folks, we're coming to a close, and I'd like to thank you very much for listening to the Métis Voices Radio program. We did really enjoy this visit with you, and we would like to also thank our directors, Don and Seth, and the gang, as well as the sponsors of the BBS radio station for allowing us to present this program to you each week. Be sure to give us your feedback about the Métis Voices radio show on the BBS radio website on the main page, and check down to our websites at www.MétisMuseum.org and our http://MétisMuseum.ning.com. Well, next week, Friday, December 26th, we will have an open line and music for the evening to celebrate the holiday seasons. Please tune in next week, same time, starting at 7:55 p.m. Standard Time. Merry Christmas to you. Merry Christmas to you, Elias. And everybody drive carefully and don't have too much cheer and stay off the roads. Until next week, we'll see you. Merci. And we'll say good night to you, Elias.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you very much. Thank you.